We begin. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Today, our panel is called Science Engagement, Redefining the Uneasy Relations with Politics and Policy, Some Transatlantic Dimensions. So in this session, we will explore the perceived decline in trust in science by society and rejection of expert opinion across Europe and the United States. So the panelists will present their empirical work and observations to address some of the following questions. So is trust in science declining? By who? What is the role of the internet and fake news? What can the scientific community do about this? Is science self-correcting, as some have claimed? Can open science save us? How should scientists engage with society given these concerns? And what are the responsibilities of the scientific community? What about science communicators? What about journalists and policymakers? So my name is Teresa Stepler. I direct the US Office of the Inter-Academy Partnership, which is a network of merit-based national academies. And this group provides provides support for evidence-based policymaking and high-quality scientific advice. I'm also a member of the Global Young Academy, a network of young or early career scholars around the world trying to make sure that science serves society. And then finally, I'm a staff member at the U.S. National Academy of Sciences. So clearly these academies, merit-based academies, care a lot about trust in science. This is really the bread and butter of academies. And so I think this panel is very timely. We hope to have a provocative session, and we want to leave as much time as possible for discussion at the end. So please be thinking of questions that you'd like to ask the panelists. They'll all come up at the end, and you'll have a chance to ask. Before we get started, I do want to thank the organizers of this session, who are Carrie Funk of the Pew Research Center and Inge Rugrock of the European Research Council Executive Agency, ERCIA. So I'll be very brief in introducing the speakers. I invite you to look at their full impressive bios in the online program, just for the sake of saving time for your questions. So our first speaker will be Dr. Carrie Funk. Carrie is the Director of Science and Society Research at Pew Research Center. And so she'll be our first speaker.
Slides going. Thank you. So I'm delighted to be here. The Pew Research Center is based in Washington, D.C. What we do is try to shed light on the issues and trends shaping society, both in the U.S. and around the world. A lot of what we do is based on public opinion surveys, and so for that we are almost always using a representative sample of adults in a given public. And then, of course, what I do is lead our research related to the consequences of science for society and what people think about it. I'm going to share with you today the highlights from a study we've done recently on among Americans on people's trust in scientists, the people who do science, and the dimensions of their thinking about scientific experts. And I think you'll see both some similarities in the U.S. case with experiences around the world. And certainly that's one of the reasons we wanted to have a transatlantic panel. And again, I want to thank Inge Rugrock from the European Research Council for helping shape a panel that would really speak to the pressing issues of the scientific communities around the world. All right, see if I can go forward. So one of the things we've done over the years is really look at these questions of public trust in science. And one of the things we do is think about trust for what. So in this case, we're showing you data from surveys over four different years that ask about the level of trust you have in different groups in society to act in the public interest. And there's a lot of data here, right? So each group is a separate measure. So you're rating your trust in the military, either a great deal, a fair amount, not too much, or not at all, your trust in scientists, medical scientists, and so on. And in the greenish, you see in the middle, the main takeaway is that among Americans, the general public trust in scientists as a group has actually gone up between 2016 and 2019. The darker green at the bottom is showing the share of people who say they have a great deal of trust in scientists to act in the public interest. It went from 21% to 35% over this period. And that's a pretty large change in a short period of time, and it stands in contrast to ratings of other groups. So that's one of the things we're often doing, is thinking about how things compare and how to place this in a broader context. Now, at the same time, there's this kind of lighter green, which I can't really point to. There's this kind of lighter green bar, and that is about half the American public. And so what we want to point out there is that's the share of Americans who say they have a fair amount of confidence in scientists to act in the public interest. So that group is what we call kind of a soft positive group. They're not strongly positive and they're not negative, but certainly in the scientific community you want that group to be a little bit smaller so that you can have the great deal of confidence to be as large as possible. So there's certainly room to grow at any one time. And that's one of the takeaways as we look at public opinion, is that it's rarely a simple up or down. There's often cross currents in public opinion, and that's what I will show you some of today. So this is a lot of information, and one of the things that we've done is try to think about public trust in scientists across different scientific groups, because science is so vast. And because we've seen in our past work that how people think about something like climate scientists is quite different than how they think about medical scientists working on childhood vaccines. It's different than how they think about GM food scientists. So we've done this study where we break down people's opinions into, you know, as we're asking about particular groups. And so here we're looking at scientists working in medicine, nutrition science, and the environment. I'm highlighting here now just environmental scientists for a minute because there's so much information on this slide. And actually what you're seeing is seven different measures about these two different groups. And just another detail for the researchers in the audience, it's actually half a sample asking about one group of environmental scientists and a random half of the other sample asking about the other. And so what I want to point out is how we think about trust. Trust, from our perspective, is multi-dimensional. There are multiple facets to trust. And we try to build on one of the common definitions of trust, that trust has to do with an expectation for the future, an idea that you can trust a group to do something in particular. And so here what we're doing is asking Americans how often they can trust scientists in these groups to, in one case, act with competence in their jobs, to show caring or concern for the public interest, and then to kind of act with trustworthiness or credibility in terms of the information they share about their work. And each of those are ratings, where you're rating how often do scientists do these kinds of things? And the bar is showing you the percentage who say they do it all the time. So that's kind of the high trust position. And these are, I'm gonna point, these are, and so what you see there is 43% of Americans saying that they trust environmental health specialists to care about the people's best interests all the time, all or most of the time. And 39% say they think environmental health scientists do a good job all or most of the time. Right. And so what you see between there is very similar measures between the two kinds of environmental scientists. Now, if that's clear, then here's all the six groups, right? And so this is the same measures across six different groups. One of the things that stands out is that Americans' trust in medical doctors and dietitians was higher compared with research scientists. And that's, again, these middle bars. That's these here, right? What's going on in the top is what we call an overall rating. It's an overall image, and that tends to be higher yet. So one of the patterns that we see across all six scientists is that you see a half or more Americans saying they have a positive overall image of these groups. You see a little more tempered judgments when it comes to trust and their competence in their caring and in their information. And then I want to point out what's on the bottom rows. So on the bottom rows are a way to get at the dimensions that could be pushing on mistrust. What are the sources of potential concern people might have about scientists? And so here we did a similar thing, asking people how often you can expect scientists to do certain things, to act with transparency when it comes to potential conflicts of interest with industry. The second one is to admit and take responsibility for their mistakes. And the third is, if they were involved in misconduct, that they would be held accountable for those misdeeds, right? And so each case you're also saying, you know, how often can you expect? So this is the share saying that all or most of the time scientists would act with transparency about potential conflicts of interest. And that's, I'm just gonna show you here. So here you see across the board, no more than 2 in 10 Americans saying that they expect those things to happen all or most of the time. So our takeaway from this is certainly that there's quite a lot of skepticism in the American public when it comes to issues of scientific integrity. And that can be a bit sobering, but I think is part of why we have meetings like this, to discuss what are the issues, what's going on, how can we move from here into addressing those kinds of initial skepticism people would have. Just letting that sink in. So then what we've done is try to think about what the public says is important in their trust in scientific research. And again, these are public ratings. These are 4 different ratings. And what we're asking is for people's own assessments of what makes them trust scientific research more or less, or perhaps has no difference in their judgments. And I thought the pattern of data is quite clear on this one. A majority of Americans saying that when they hear about scientific research where the data is openly available to the public, that makes them trust the research more. About half saying when they hear about data where it's been reviewed by an independent group, that makes them trust the research more. And then, of course, on the bottom is that the sources of funding matter in people's judgments as well. On the bottom row, when they hear about research being funded by industry groups, that tends to raise people's wariness, and kind of more mixed picture when it comes to hearing about government-funded research, with, I think, about half saying that it makes no difference, and the rest divided between whether that would increase or decrease their trust. So obviously, these are judgments that people make. It doesn't mean that they actually go into the data and look at it. It means that this is when they hear about this, this is how they would react. This is a judgment that they make in terms of being open in discussion about these things, having those kinds of cues of credibility, people say, makes them think about it in a more positive light. We actually did a similar series to try to get a parallel set of questions around science practitioners, and found a very similar pattern of results. All right, now there's other things going on in terms of how people think about science and scientific experts in society. And one of the things we find is that there are divides in the American public around how people think about scientific experts. And these are 3 questions to kind of touch on that. The one is that around 6 in 10 Americans saying that scientists should take an active role in policy debates about scientific issues, and roughly 4 in 10 saying no, they should stay out and instead focus on their research. In the middle is asking people whether scientific experts make better science policy decisions than other people, about 45% of Americans saying yes, combined together, about half or more saying that no, they either make decisions kind of equal value or worse. There's actually, it's a small saying worse, so it's about 7% saying worse, but on average, more people saying no, not better. And then the third question is kind of what do you think about scientists in terms of the nature of their judgments? And this is a strong statement, but the idea is on On balance, do you see scientists as making judgments based solely on the facts? Are they fact-based, objective judgments, or are they kind of as subject to bias as any other person's judgments? And so here you see, again, a kind of close divide among the American public overall. Now, I think what is perhaps more telling is one factor in these views does have to do with politics. And the red bars are people who are Republicans or independents who lean to the Republican Party, which is our more right-leaning party in the U.S. And the blue are the Democrats, the more left-leaning party. And so what you see there is that the share of Republicans who take these stands is smaller and quite different than the Democrats. So Republicans more likely to say that scientists should stay out of science policy debates, that they're no more likely than other people to make good policy judgments, and that their judgments themselves are just as likely to be biased as other people's relative to Democrats. Now, public opinion, as I said, is rarely a simple up or down. And so what you've seen already is some of the mix in terms of people's views as you dig deeper and you see that there are both kind of positives and negatives going on as you dig below the surface. But at the same time, I want to point out this broad picture here, that the big picture is that there are strong majorities in the U.S. who see science as bringing benefits to society, and big majorities who say that they expect more benefits to come ahead. So the point of taking this kind of balanced view in terms of trust and potential sources of mistrust is if you want to broaden the audience for scientists, if you want to broaden engagement with scientists, you need to better understand where those sources of skepticism are so that you can address them and move forward in that context. So that final words, I would just say, we're involved in an ongoing effort to understand public perspectives about science. We touch on emerging science and tech issues. We look at opinion about a variety of science-related attitudes. We look at issues facing the STEM workforce. And science, of course, is a global pursuit. So it has no boundaries. And so our next research is focused on looking at public opinion about the role of science in a comparative context, where we're in the middle of doing a study across 20 different publics. And that will allow us, of course, to make direct comparisons in terms of what do Americans think overall compared with other publics. But I hope today in our discussion we'll be able to touch on some of the similarities and differences that you experience. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Carrie. Our next speaker is Jason Reifler. He's a professor of political science at the University of Exeter. Jason.
Thank you all for having me here today. So I'm going to talk about my ERC-funded project, Debunker, which is looking at the problem of misperception. So when people believe things about the world that are contrary to consensus expert opinion and our best available evidence. And my longtime co-author, Brendan Nyhan, and I started working on this around 15 years ago. And it started with the observation that about 2 years after the start of the Iraq War, there was still a very large proportion of the American public that believed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So we conducted what we thought would be a simple one-off experiment that would compare different ways to correct misinformation, and that we would then have this very practical, usable piece of information about how to help people update their beliefs. And what we found turned out to be take us on a now 15-year journey. And in this experiment, we had our participants read a news article, a real news article. We did the study in 2005, about a campaign speech that then President George W. Bush gave as part of his reelection effort, in which he talked about Saddam Hussein, he talked about the threat that weapons of mass destruction posed. And after that, we asked people, did Iraq have weapons of mass destruction? Now, what we did as our experiment is that half of our respondents got one extra paragraph. And in this extra paragraph, we said, the same day that George W. Bush gave this speech, the CIA released a report saying that, in fact, Iraq didn't have a weapons of mass destruction program like the kind that had been the key of the case to going to war in the first place. And what we found was that liberals who received this corrective message compared to liberals who did not decreased in the proportion who said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. Among conservatives who received this extra paragraph saying that the US government has decided that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction, compared to those who didn't get this extra paragraph, were more likely to say that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So it went in exactly the wrong direction. So we've been studying this backfire effect now for about 15 years. And so there, one thing that I want to really stress is that in this original article, we did 5 studies, and we found a backfire effect in 2 out of 5. So it doesn't happen all the time. And a lot of work that we've done since, we find that a backfire effect is probably the exception more than the rule. It does happen, and a lot of the current project is trying to better understand exactly under what conditions a backfire effect occurs. Now, we're interested broadly in the spread of misinformation. So we have recently done another study in which we wanted to understand fake news. So we've heard a lot about fake news, especially as it relates to the 2016 US presidential election. And it just so happened that we happened to have a study in the field during fall of 2016 in which allowed us to measure actual rates of fake news consumption in the United States. And what we found is both alarming and reassuring at the same time. So using a simple binary measure of did somebody visit a fake news website, we found the very alarming statistic that approximately 44% of the US public visited a fake news website during the 2016 presidential election. So that's a very high number. More reassuringly, though, if we look at just what's the proportion of people's overall news information diet that is constituted by fake news, it's actually only about 6%. And even that's still misleading because that consumption is overwhelmingly concentrated in the 10 to 20% of the electorate that has the most conservative news media diets overall. So depending on how you look at it, it can be either really, really frightening or not as frightening. In additional analyses that we did, we find that fake news is very unlikely to have changed the outcome of the 2016 presidential election. We see no relationship between visiting fake news websites and likelihood to turn out, or in vote preference. Now, another study that we did, because we're interested not just in how people respond, not just in sort of the spread of, we're interested in the spread of misinformation. And so one of the things that we wanted to look at was how does misinformation spread? How do misperceptions take root? So we did another study in which we compared the effect of explicit conspiracy messages with implicit conspiracy messages. So what do I mean by that? In this study, we looked at belief that the Zika outbreak was a conspiracy by vaccine manufacturers to spread a disease in order to be able to sell vaccines. And in our experimental conditions, some respondents received this very explicit conspiracy message. This was done by vaccine manufacturers, or actually a larger company that owns a subsidiary that releases the genetically modified mosquitoes that are actually the way to control Zika, but that's actually the conspiracy, is that's how Zika is spread, to just a simple implicit conspiracy message, where we don't give people all the details, and we just say, well, when we think about why Zika now, we need to think about who benefits. And that those two messages were roughly equally effective in spreading conspiracy ideation about vaccines and about Zika. So I think this gets very powerfully back to Carrie's point about sort of trust in science being really, really important. I'm gonna check how I'm doing on time. Okay. And I wanna talk about one more study really quickly. So we've looked at how people respond to information. We want to try and get a better sense of why there's variation in how some people respond to messages and other people don't respond to them. So we've recently done another study, and we wanted to look at the possibility that guidelines for how long to take antibiotics might change. So as you may or may not know, in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, there was an article published a couple years ago saying that the official guidance to take the antibiotics for the full course, even if you start feeling better, should be replaced with guidance to just stop when you feel better. We want to see how people would respond to changing this guidance. And we found some good news, which was people were willing to change their, for the most part, if we gave them the new expert guidelines, or said, this is what experts now think you should do, for the most part, people would respond to it, even if it ran contrary to their prior beliefs about how long you should take antibiotics. But what we also found was that there's a particular subset of the population, those that are extremely confident in their own knowledge, particularly in their own knowledge relative to experts, and that changes in expert guidance have zero effect with them. So this broader sort of individual level attitude or the variation in how much deference people have to experts is now where we're increasingly orienting the project going forward to understand this and understand the distribution, to understand how it might be related to political attitudes. Now, I want to leave with three main takeaway points. First and foremost is that the backfire effect is not universal. This is one of the things that is sort of meta correction about corrections that we have to address. While we remain confident in our work and that the backfire effect happens sometimes, it is not universal. It does not always happen. So the project going forward, again, one of the key things is to try and understand under what conditions specifically a backfire effect happens. And I think that matters a lot for science communication, because sometimes people have interpreted our results to mean, oh, we just have to give up. Everything is terrible. We should just quit. And our results more broadly do not support that. Second is that there is an important distinction between the spread of misinformation, sort of the supply, and the demand for misinformation. So when trying to counter misinformation, it's probably much easier to change the supply than it is the demand. Changing human behavior very broadly is really, really hard. Changing incentive structures to limit the spread of misinformation is also really hard, just probably not as hard. And then finally, there is really important individual level difference and variation in how people respond to messages, particularly messages that are deemed to be coming from experts. And my little buzzer is going off, so that means I think I am done. Thank you.
Thank Thank you so much, Jason. So our next speaker is Claudia Aradel. She's a professor of international politics at King's College London.
So thank you very much, and I want to start by thanking Inge Ruigroeg and the European Research Council for inviting me to take part today, even though I am at the beginning of a project, rather than telling you about the results of the project. But I want to address some of the bigger questions, and I want to give you around the relation between science and politics. And I also want to give you a little bit of background in terms of my own interests, so maybe that you can see a bit more of where I'm coming from, not least because a lot of the debates have considered, you know, medicine and questions about environment and climate change. My interest, so my discipline is international relations, and I'm interested a lot in how digital technologies, you know, big data and algorithms are transforming the modes of security governance, right? And many of you will have heard about the use of digital technologies and big data, for instance, for predictive policing, right, for borders, like facial recognition, and so on. And if you think about this debate, so some of the key issues around these have not been that, you know, people do not trust, you know, in the kind of objective algorithm and so on, but the opposite, right, that the algorithms are discriminatory, that they target particularly vulnerable categories, right, that they are not ethical and so on. So it's kind of the opposite. So how do we deal with that? Right? And some of these arguments have been tied with these questions of distrust in science, right? And I don't want to pick on the kind of ideas of computer science, but I want to think more broadly, right, about how we think about these tensions. And my own discipline of international relations, right, has thought a lot and has had to deal with a lot of tensions between, you know, politics and science being so close at the interface with politics, and I'll come back to that. So I chose here post-truth, right, to approach these questions of trust and distrust, not particularly because I like the term. You will see that I would say that we shouldn't use it, because I think it's a particularly problematic term. But I chose it because it's been a diagnosis of what has been going on, right? And this is kind of going back to 2016 when the Oxford English Dictionary chose post-truth as the word of the year. And it had a lot of traction. I mean, we have seen in Carrie's presentation that things are a bit more complicated when people kind of get asked about their views. But it's been a word that has circulated a lot through the media. You know, people have used it, but also have used it to also claim truth back again. So what I want to do today is talk about these three elements in my title. So start with the kind of questions of post-truth, then propose a different way to think about the relation between science and politics in terms of credibility, and then end with an argument about critique as kind of a social scientist. So firstly, I want to argue that, or I want to propose that we should avoid or give up on the idea on the terminology of post-truth. I think it's particularly pernicious in two ways. Firstly, because it assumes this binary between truth and post-truth, you know, this kind of idea that everything is different today because we live in a post-truth world, and oh, aren't we nostalgic about the world of truth that science used to have when things were clear and, you know, boundaries were drawn and unambiguous. But I think there's also a second reason for which we should try to avoid the use of post-truth. Because I think what it has done, it has created, or it has brought, it has intensified hierarchies within science itself, within different disciplines, and within particular approaches within science. Right. So again, many of you have probably heard that, again, in the media, we saw debates or diagnoses of post-truth also blaming, you know, this advent of post-truth onto particular approaches, right? Often associated with social constructivist approaches, or, you know, even worse, what used to be called postmodern approaches, right? So people who kind of talked about the social construction of, you know, different things around us, but also people who kind of paid attention to contingency, right, to indeterminacy, and so on. And I think that this is problematic because it reinforces, it brings back a series of hierarchies within sciences themselves, where particular types of approaches and particular disciplines kind of get disqualified, as it were. Not to mention that I think it's a little bit problematic, right, as an argument to try to imagine that, you know, a lot of this work that many had criticized before as being difficult and maybe a bit, hard to understand is basically the work that Trump and his advisors are sitting down and reading, you know, Jacques Derrida and Judith Butler, for those of you who have heard about this. So instead of truth, post-truth, right, I would like to propose that we think about credibility, that credibility and the credibility in the relation between science and politics is actually a more useful, a more helpful concept. And I think it also allows us to rethink this relation between science and politics. So here, over the past days, I heard a lot of discussion about the interface between science and politics. Right? And we often talk, I used interface myself at the beginning of this talk. We also use interface, and that kind of gives us the impression that there are two different fields that somehow meet at the interface, right? So that science is a sort of separate field, a separate arena. And it is this autonomy and separation that gives scientists authorities and kind of justifies the production of authoritative evidence. On the other, if we take this idea of autonomy, we also run into the issue that any type or, you know, of external factor that interferes upon this autonomy, and again we saw in Kerry's talk, can jeopardize this authority and or authoritative evidence. For example, questions of funding, it depends where the funding comes from, questions of interest, and these are more broadly questions of politics. But if we talk about credibility, then we can think about how the credibility of scientific work is created not only internally, right, within an autonomous field, not only, let's say, within the laboratory or through, you know, peer-reviewed publications, but it is also created through the circulation of knowledge and so certain public dimensions of scientific knowledge. Right? So the credibility of scientific knowledge is not established only in relation to scientists, of scientists to each other, but also in relation to these public dimensions, to different publics. And, you know, this circulates also through different means in society quite widely. So we can take, I'll give you, you know, one example. We can take DNA research, for instance, which is an interesting contemporary case of how scientific knowledge thrives on wide public visibility and acquires credibility through its circulation across different fields, which includes news media, government, police, and so on, but also public culture, right? Think of all the crime series that, you know, people watch on TV and Netflix and so on, where DNA evidence is used to catch and convict criminals, right? So there's this kind of wide visibility, but also wide circulation, a particular, you know, particular ideas and particular arguments for science. So in an earlier, an article that came out earlier this year, my colleague Jeff Heisman and I have argued that credibility is particularly useful to use to think about science because it alerts us to a whole series of terms that give us, you know, I think a more complex understanding of this relation. So these are credentials, accreditation, credit, credence, but also credulity and incredulity. Right? So thinking about credibility means we need to think about how the credibility of scientific knowledge is a social and political accomplishment, right? How it requires work, how it can be acquired, but how it can also be challenged and how it can also be lost, right? So questions of credulity and incredulity also alert us to the problems of believing too much or believing too little, believing too soon or believing too slowly, right? So we have a kind of a whole set of elements, and we can't limit ourselves to just questions of credentials and accreditation, which of course are key to entering a scientific field, right? But also not simply to internal questions about the credits that we get for our knowledge, for example, through publishing in peer-reviewed journals and high-ranking journals, and so on. So if we take credibility in this understanding that it is a social and political achievement, right, that's something that is done, right, across this boundary between science and politics through engagement with all these publics, it means that we cannot draw a strict boundary between the internal conditions of science and external social and political factors, right? That also means that we need to pay attention and analyze the practices of making, circulating, and crediting scientific knowledge. So take, for example, the debates, again, that link to my interest in big data, the debates between statistics and statistical methods versus big data and big data methods, right? So how have we come to have, this credibility of big data methods? In a recent book that was published by Central European University Press, Helga Novotny, raises this question, and she's arguing that actually big data is a big challenge to statistics. And I quote, as you can see here, she says, "Statistics are collected on the basis of knowing which questions to ask. The categories to be used are determined in advance, usually from governments and from above. The data on which predictive analytics are based have a different origin. They result from the sweeping collecting of all the traces we leave behind in a digital economy and society. Big data have a built-in flexibility that allows them to answer questions that they were not collected for. They can be repurposed." Right. Novotny's conclusion is a rather pessimistic one, because she's arguing that quantitative evidence has lost much of its clout. Now, based on my experience over the past few days, I think she's way too pessimistic, and that's not true, right? We've seen a lot of statistical evidence, a lot of quantitative knowledge across a lot of reports. However, if we think about this contestation between statistical methods and big data methods and increasing credibility of big data, right, we cannot account for this if we don't think about the role of big tech companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, and so on, you name it, right? And this kind of circulation of these methods and the credibility of this knowledge. So how do we explain the rush to artificial intelligence in all areas of social life? Can we do it without understanding what has been called surveillance capitalism, right? The extraction of value from all this data. So therefore, I would like to suggest that the relation between science and politics is messier than we might like it to be, right? But it also means that there's more that we can do, that there are many fields of social life that we can be engaged in, that we can think about credibility beyond simply the credentials, of scientific method or scientific instruments, of peer reviewing or research funding. So as I argued, credibility can be acquired, it can be challenged and even lost. But none of this is easy, and this is a good thing, right? And that takes me to the third and final point, which is about critique. So as we talk about the interface between science and policy, we also talk about the scientific community, and probably all of us have used this terminology of scientific community here, and it all sounds like a cozy place where everything is calm and peaceful and we get on with each other, as hopefully we do, but at the same time, we know that science is traversed by many debates, right? By many criticisms, by many controversies. So scientists discuss and debate a lot. That's what we do. That's part of our job. I'm finishing. So not a lot of these debates are public, right? They can often take place. This is my final bit. They can often take place behind closed doors, sometimes in the pages of journals. But they also mean controversies might be amplified and circulated in different ways. This does not mean that controversies are not closed, right? Scientists know also how to close controversies. As Bruno Latour remarked, Bruno Latour, who's work has been, you know, most famously associated with the analysis of scientific controversies. So I would like to close by suggesting that scientists need to be more open about the controversies that take place in their own fields, in their own disciplines, right? The critiques of particular methods, of particular perspectives, and different responses to problems, right? So we have a lot of critique in science. We teach it to students. So we should look again, right, to integrate this critique also in our, you know, public debates, in disengagement with different publics, to integrate not just successes but also failures, not just closed controversies but also ongoing ones, right? The solutions that scientists offer are never perfect. They are contested, and I think that's fine. We just need to acknowledge, you know, the place for these critiques, right? Not just to ourselves but also to the varied publics we engage with. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Introduce you. Okay, so next we have Professor Alexander Gerber. He's the program chair and research director of the Rheinwall University of Applied Sciences in Germany. He's also the founder and head of research at InSyco and is using Prezi.
Make it complicated.
Okay. Fancy is always more complicated. First of all, thank you very much for having me. I see so many renowned colleagues in the room. Let me just send out the tweet, because that was a real time. There you go. Well, I suppose I'm going to try not just to add a few points, but also connect some of the dots of the things that have already been said. As I said, it's great to have so many of you here with us this morning, like maybe one to welcome one of us representing the others, Monsieur Bourguignon. So if we could maybe welcome you in particular, c'est un grand plaisir de vous accueillir ici. And the idea of the next couple of minutes would be to myth bust what science communication is apparently contributing to this and where we might need to get better. So first of all, let's maybe quickly start with some question time. You've listened now to three excellent presentations, just very briefly. A methodological, not entirely robust, but let's do a little survey. If we were to ask to address global challenges, just such as climate change, would you say that scientific evidence must have a stronger influence on policymaking? If those were the Likert items down there, strongly agree, somewhat agree. Think about it for a second. If we could do this by a show of hands very quickly, and we start with the strongest agreement. There's also, of course, a wish not to know, wish not to tell. Oh, sorry for the no, that's a copy-paste error. If you don't know, you can maybe do this or whatever. So shall we try that quickly? Who does strongly agree to that? Holy cats. I was expecting something, but not that. Okay. So the others agree, I suppose. Is there anyone who is neutral? No? Does anyone dare to disagree now after me priming you in that manner? Wow, okay, strong disagreement. Does anyone not wish to tell? Wow, okay, so that certainly was an experiment worth conducting. Second point, in order to address global climate change, people in general need to have more trust in independent research. We've just heard it. Recognize the independent here, so that would probably not be the industrially funded research. Whether that actually is such a major difference or not is a different question, but think about it for a second. Super strong agreement. Who strongly agrees with that statement? Okay, people are getting more careful now with my experiment. Agree? Okay, so that's probably the majority. Neutral? Somewhat? We forgot the somewhat thing. Oh, okay. disagree? Strongly disagree? Okay. You do notice a certain pattern, I suppose. So, real-time data collection. I do think that the first question, to some extent, constitutes what we actually usually criticize as a knowledge deficit, that we believe that there's a lack of knowledge which needs to be complemented. And the second one, and I'm going to say a few words about that now, is that we might think that there is a trust deficit and that it's our job to amend it. As I said, I've just sent out a tweet about 1 minute ago about a study we're conducting on responsible research and innovation. It's probably the largest study ever done in the field. We do that in 14 languages around the whole world. As it happens, the project coordinator is actually amongst us and sitting here, the charming gentleman in the fourth row. Thanks, Gordon, for coming. That is a survey which I think is running at least for another 2 weeks or so, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, Eric says. It would be great if you could consider participating. As I said, you'll find that on Twitter. Let me very quickly jump back. Sorry for that, just in case you have not seen that. There's a link up there, bit.ly, WSF minus AG19. That is the Prezi that I'm showing at the moment. You can browse it in real time. If I'm too fast or too slow, you can fast forward me or stop me anytime. And that's my Twitter handle in case you want to follow or comment. I'm not sure if I can read that while I'm presenting, but anyway. I think there are two problems with what the social experiment we just conducted showed. And the first one is attitude, and the other one is the effect. Let me quickly try to make a few points here. How reasonable is it to brand decisions as unreasonable, as irrational? We have to be aware that there's a large difference between some of the irrational and making unreasonable decisions. Promoting or demanding reason and accusing people of being irrational is something that also is a certain pattern in the scientific community. It was Daniel Kahneman, whose book I suppose most of us have read, Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, who describes this misconception as a stubborn resistance to reasonable arguments. So why don't they get it? Why don't they listen? Can't they just accept the fact? Why don't they buy into us with our scientific method and the rigor that we apply? I'm wondering if instead, that's not Kahneman, that's me, we need to find means of improving the process of reasoning itself. And that is more about understanding empirically what the predictors and the influences are when it comes to trust, when it comes to decision making and so on. And that process of reasoning, the colleague just said it, is super complex. And we're talking about something that is psychologically and systemically extremely complex. Next point. If we were to assume that there is a deficiency of people making rational decisions, then the only test of rationality would actually be not whether someone's preferences or beliefs are reasonable, but whether they are internally consistent. It's perfectly rational for someone to say, I like to be hated. Yeah, as long as they're consistent with that attitude. So we also have different conceptualizations of what rationality might mean. It was Milton Friedman then who asked whether it might even be immoral to protect people against presumably irrational choices. Could be immoral to tell people what they're supposed to believe or not. So how democratic is it actually to assume we can say we know this better? The probability is X, and the confidence interval is Y. So that's where libertarian paternalism comes in. Paternalism, for those who have children, kind of the parental care for what people should be doing and the decisions that they're making. But libertarian, at the same time, the freedom that comes with it. Nudging is, Taylor Sunstein's theory, nudging is a great concept that I think also relates very much to what the colleague has been saying. So how do we nudge people in a certain direction? Like we're using judgmental heuristics to our advantage, the heuristics which actually determine most of the decisions that we're making on a daily basis. So there is an issue with the attitude when we approach this topic. Let's look at the effect of all of this. If we were to assume for a moment that this, what we've just seen, demonstrated to ourselves, so to speak, is a certain, if I may be so blunt, misconception of a deficit of knowledge and trust and attitude, then if that is a deficit-driven desire for defending here the scientific evidence, are we taking the scientific evidence sufficiently into account when it comes to things you've just heard, the psychology, things we know about how decisions are made and how attitudes form? How can we be more effective when engaging with the stakeholders in research and innovation? What do we know about what makes this engagement, this communication, more effective? My answer would be, and that we were supposed to be provocative, so I suppose that's what I'm trying to do here, for once, for those who know me. We need to practice what we preach, and we do that more than we've done it in the past. We're supposed to use the evidence to understand the following. How is information processed? How is this sold by people? Information behavior. Again, we've heard a lot about that. It's much easier to change the information supply than the information demand. That we need to understand better how attitudes form, how opinions form. This is, from a sort of psychological perspective, a really complex undertaking. We're only really starting to understand this, how decisions are made in the political world, and which role trust plays. Not just whether there's trust or as none and how it increases or decreases, but also what the determinants are. This needs to be looked at different levels, as you can see down here below. So finishing with a few thoughts, because I think we want to go into a discussion as soon as possible. There are a couple of things we do know. So these are just glimpses, as I said, a few ideas. What is the evidence out there? And I noted on backfiring effect, which I haven't in my list. If I had known you were talking about it, I would have definitely added it. It's a great example. Motivated reasoning is one. We heard earlier the correlation between political affiliation and people's willingness or interest in having more science involved in policy making. I mean, that is, you could again say, that's irrational. Why would that be the case? You know, the political party affiliation shouldn't influence whether we want scientists to be involved or not, regardless of what it is that they're going to put forward. Exactly, because we're knowing they're going to probably support one side or the other. So there's a lot of, let's say, understanding from half a century of research in this field when it comes to motivated reasoning, confirmation bias. People have written about the negativity dominance, that bad is always stronger than good. If you have a large crowd and yet you see one angry face among 100 people, it's easy for you to recognize. If you want to see the one happy face and one 100 negative faces, you're not going to find it. So this is something that has been part of our behavior and thinking for hundreds of thousands of years. John Gottman, actually, I love this example for all of those who are in long-term relationships, that a long-term success of a relationship depends much more on avoiding the negative than on seeking the positive. So you actually should try to avoid those negative experiences, apart from, you know, trying to bring flowers every night, because good interactions need to outnumber the bad ones by 5-1. Impact on trust, being built or destroyed, all of that trust research that has been undertaken, cognitive ease and availability bias. We don't have the time to go into that. Just to give you a few glimpses, there's a lot of evidence out there which should inform so much deeper what it is that we're doing and that we should be doing. Framing, priming, anchoring effects, wonderful. You know, we're just selling property. If you know how the anchoring effect works, you can just make a significant amount of more, like make more money, if that actually matters. Risk aversion, that we're prone to avoid risk, and that determines to a large extent many of the decisions we're making. The spiral of silence, that people actually feel so strongly influenced by the decisions made by others. And that might be something we could pick up in the debate or in the discussion. Should be more a dialogue than a debate, I suppose. What we call inoculation theory, that we are increasingly finding out that there is probably a much larger potential in pre-bunking, fake news, and misinformation, disinformation. We maybe also need to dissect those two, than in debunking it. I know that also the European Commission is putting a lot of effort with its European Science Media Hub and Science, how are they called? What? No, that's not what I meant. I think that we have our first question for the discussion, actually, yeah. Interesting point. We may, the colleague and I may actually probably not entirely agree on that, but having different sides. And there's so much more. There's political science, there's economic science, like diffusion of innovation tells us so much of how innovation actually that happens, works, or is impeded. sociology, philosophy of science, history of science. So there's so much evidence out there that it's such a shame we're not really making it. Oh, there's another slide coming. Let's see if I get to that. No, that's very easy. There's a paper coming up with a colleague sitting in the first row, and I think either filming or taking a picture for some reason. We wanted it to actually be published before this event, but I think it's coming up in the next week. So if you stay connected, it would be lovely to share it with you. That's the first paper actually about a concept of evidence-based science communication. I see several of you taking pictures. Thank you very much indeed. It's very flattering. And we don't have the time, I think, one more minute, or am I over time?
30 seconds.
That's enough. That's enough for me. One of the things you're suggesting is a so-called knowledge cascade, that there are four, is it four? No, three. Four aspects of it. We need to determine how relevant is the respective evidence that we need for a certain decision. Then if we acknowledge that relevance, we need to make it relevant, we need to make it accessible. Sorry, we talked about accessibility and whether just putting out an open open access paper which nobody understands is not necessarily the answer, as we all know. Then once access, how do we enhance the transferability? So do we actually incorporate that idea of how can that be used? How can it be applied? How can it be transferred? And once it's transferred, to relying on quality assurance transferable knowledge that leads us to, that's why, you know, the reference to evidence-based medicine, the systematic and systemic understanding of how do we assess the best available evidence in the field. That was it. See, that wasn't that long. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm enjoying it.
Thank you so much, Alex, and even some evidence-based relationship advice, which is always nice. Our last speaker, if I can change out.
Yeah, I'll do it for you. Okay. I messed it up, so I may as well fix it.
Oh, see.
There you go. Okay. This one?
Yeah.
It's probably open already.
Okay, thank you. Our last speaker is Sigurd Klotting, who's the president of Academia Europaea, the Academy of Europe, as well as the chair of the board of SAPIA, Science Advice for Policy for European Academies. And he will be giving his perspective. So, Sigurd.
First of all, a big thank you to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to share with you some perspectives from SAPEA. SAPEA stands for Scientific Advice for Policy by the European Academies. It's part of the scientific advice mechanism set up by the European Commission in 2015, where it makes part of an ecosystem composed of SAPEA itself, but also the group of chief scientific advisors, 7 eminent scientists, and also having a component called the SEM unit, which is a unit within the Commission that makes sure that our reports land on the desk of recipients. And the recipients is not only, let's say, the Commissioner for Research and Innovation, but it's the whole Commission, including the chair of the Commission. And I think this is very important, that we have recipients who are waiting for our reports. Apart from, let's say, the questions they give us, we have also the right to come up ourselves with topics in a bottom-up way. So I think it is really symmetrical happiness in this system, and I can assure you it works. Just a few examples of evidence reviews published to date. You can see from the list of topics, they're pretty broad. And that's exactly where the academies come in, because the academies, and this is basically, this consortium is made up of federations of national academies, but also ESAC. It has a long standing record of high quality advice. And the Pan-European Academy, Academia Europaea, with more than 4,000 members from all over Europe. Basically, the knowledge we have in the academies is indeed of a nature that is capable to come up with this evidence review report, because we have the knowledge not only in the natural sciences, but also a large pool of knowledge in the social sciences and humanities. And I think this is very important. You might wonder, why academies? Well, very simple, independent advice. That's the nature of the game. And the academies are seen by the Commission as basically a disinterested party. Not that we are not interested, but we don't have ourselves a specific interest. And I think this is very important to be credible in the game. Reports on various topics. Of course, what is crucial is the composition of the working groups. Here we can fall back, let's say, to the members of the different academies. More than 100 academies all over Europe are involved, but it's not only the membership of the academies that we mobilize, also beyond that. And we have seen in the few years that the mechanism exists that there is a very strong motivation by our members and other people to serve in this capacity. Really, it's no problem to find experts. And I think this is very, very important. We go, of course, for scientific excellence. Also, of course, for us, it's very important to have diversity in the working groups. Also, to have the young people involved. After all, we talk about, in many cases, about the future. What is also important, of course, is the quality assurance process for the publications. And that means extensive peer review and, of course, the full endorsement by the network partners. That's all in the game. So it is a very transparent and independent process. And what is for us very important is, of course, to have a very strong dialogue between what's going on the European level and what's going on a national level. We have the ambition to go for a SAPIA 2 under the new commission. And one of our ambitions is also to export this model to national academies and counties which have not yet a scientific advice mechanism in operation. And I think that is very, very important also to build up here best practice. Well, making sense of science for policy, that is basically a topic that is very close to the heart of the scientific consortium. But also very close to the heart of the Commission. The Commission asked for this report, and Academia Europaea served as the lead academy. And I think the contents of this report is very much, let's say, in the core of the topics discussed at our session. How to provide good science advice to European Commission policymakers based on available evidence under conditions of scientific complexity and uncertainty. A lot of the issues that have been discussed so far deal with this. This report is there. And on the basis of this report, the group of chief scientific advisors produced a report, a follow-up report for the Commission. So I think it is a very important point to realize that it is basically a multi-component system with clearly defined roles. It's one thing to give advice, another thing is to receive it. And basically to implement some of the recommendations. But it's very clear, it's science for policy. It's not policy for science. And our ambition is not to sit on the seats of the policy makers. But we are very pleased that the Commission had a vision to set up this mechanism. I think that's a very important signal in the world that we live today, where we had yesterday a very interesting session in the Central European University on academic freedom. This is also part of our academic freedom and to give independent advice. And it's very clear that in Europe there's more work to be done, and I think that the Commission here is basically a front runner. And again, the mechanism works. This is the handover of the Making Sense of Science report and the scientific opinion by the group of chief scientific advisors, and also the handover of a very important report on this issue by the Joint Research Center of the Commission. And these people are the people in the middle. And I think you will agree with me that this is a fairly happy crowd. Each of them has its role. Each of them is doing a great job. Outreach, very important. Very important, of course, to have basically feedback. Also, very important, of course, to have impact. And also to build trust. And, of course, there are different components in this system. The researchers themselves, Of course, for that, we are actively participating in scientific conferences on the policy topic itself. We have events and panel discussions organized by national academies. To the policymakers, events organized by the European Commission, the European Parliament, also a very important player in the game of legislation, because the Commission, of course, needs this report to make decisions on legislation, and briefings organized by national academies, and communication to EU think tanks, NGOs, and other stakeholders. And then, of course, the general public, the people, which are very important for the acceptance of science in general, science festivals, of course, social media activity, and also online discussions. So let me finish here with showing you a few examples of what's being done by SAPEA, again, in partnership with other organizations. This is an example of outreach to researchers in the case of Making Sense of Science, evidence-informed policy from the Norwegian perspective. Norwegian Academy is also a front runner in this this game, and this event was organized by our hub in Bergen, the Academia Europea hub, and the Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters earlier in November, discussing the European dimension, but also, again, the national dimension. This is an example of outreach to the policy makers, in this case on the topic of food from the ocean, where the request came from the European Commissioner for Fisheries in terms of the view on the future of feeding a population, a global population that is, of course, steadily increasing. And this meeting was co-organized by the European Marine Board, European Commission, and the Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission of UNESCO. So again, it's not a standalone effort. It's in partnership with those organizations that make the difference. And finally, outreach to the general public, a Cardiff Science Festival, bringing it to the people who have to live with the decisions taken by the policymakers today. So I like to leave it here. In summary, we are building up some best practice on a European level and also on a national level in a number of European countries. It's learning by doing. And to bring it back to the title of this session, the relationship between science and policy, it's not always that uneasy. There are cases where it works. And again, the key point is to have a recipient. The scientific community is very clearly very motivated for that. And in that context, I'm very happy that this session is on the menu of the World Science meeting. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you so much, Seard. And as a person involved, as I mentioned, with academies, I hope the academies can really take forward this research that we see from our colleagues here, as well as others are doing, to make sure that this independent advice has the most impact on policy as possible. I think that's really key, not only in Europe, but across the world. So I'd like to now invite our panelists to come forward and have a seat up front, so we can have questions. Please begin thinking of your questions. I think we'll take a few at a time and then allow the panelists to address them. If they're for a particular panelist, would you please note that? And it would also be really great if you could just very briefly state your name and institution before you speak. And if you could keep your questions very succinct, with a question mark at the end of them. That's really ideal. No, I think I'll stay here just because there's not that many microphones. I think to turn on the microphone, there's a button on the bottom, and then my colleague here will run the mic to the audience. Okay, thank you so much. Does anyone have a question to start? Yes, Angela, here, please. Can we get the microphone?
Thank you. Somebody has to break the ice.
Yeah, thank you.
Angela Liberatore at the European Research Council Executive Agency. Thanks for a brilliant panel. A question which is, I guess, mainly for Claudia, but possibly also for Alex, and one to you, Sjoerd. The question to Claudia and Alex is, you were rightly so mentioning the need to be transparent, or how at least to deal with scientific controversies, not just as something behind the doors, but something to be addressed. So what do you think are the ways of discussing scientific controversies also with people both within and outside their research community in a way that allows debate, the understanding that there are plurality of approaches and so on and so forth, without getting in the risk of everything goes, they are just any other opinion and so on. So that's question number one. The question to you, Sjoerd, is while you have been also in the Scientific Council of ERC and you're now working on science policy, how do you find the easiness or uneasiness of the notion of the independence of science and the notion of being relevant? Is there a tension, or there are good ways to preserve the independence of science actually as a way to be really relevant rather than instrumentalized?
Okay, thank you so much. So we have another question over here, Elisa. So how do we address scientific controversies, and then for Sjoerd, independence versus relevance? So Elisa.
Okay, I'm Elisa Reis from Rio de Janeiro and from the International Science Council. I have a trivial question for Carrie. I wonder if you have correlated trust into science with general trust. That's all.
I was going to take one more, and then, yeah. Truth in science versus general trust, and then one more, I'll let you each answer, and we can take another group.
Thank you. Attila Havas, Institute of Economics, Center for Economic and Regional Studies, formerly belonging to the Academy of Sciences in Hungary. Not anymore. I have a question to Alex. I have not really understood your first question, and the meaning of the first question, especially when you said that it can be interpreted as knowledge deficit. If there is no visible impact of scientific advice on policymaking, for me it is not necessarily knowledge deficit. It can be ignorance, it can be a different rationale what policymakers follow, different interests, different value systems. So there could be many other reasons besides lack of knowledge about the most recent and most valid scientific advice. And the second is a remark, it's not a question. Just I would like to mention that I know that the topic of this session is scientific advice. This is an absolutely important point, but I would like to stress that there are other methods, participatory methods, when stakeholders are also involved. And in the broader picture of policymaking, I think it's also an important approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so maybe we'll stop there. And I think a question on that is whether these stakeholder participatory approaches you think increase trust in science, and whether there's evidence for that, I'd be interested in that. So maybe if we could start with whoever would like to start addressing any of those issues we've heard.
Oh, okay, it's on. So how do we address controversies, and why are they not simply opinions? So I would like to link to the point that was made about participatory methods, right? Because one thing I've been wondering about, we talked about kind of social media in terms of talking to different publics. But of course, in my discipline and a lot of social sciences, right, there are other methods in which citizens are brought in, but also non-citizens, right, when they are the, you know, they're not just the object of research, but they're subjects of research. And I think that does two things. One, it kind of shows what hard work it is to produce this knowledge, right? So as we know, it's not just an opinion, like we don't wake up in the morning and come up with whatever, right? It's months and months of work, of gathering data, of working with it, right? So kind of getting more people involved in that. I think it's really, to me, it's really important. That's kind of, that's one way to think about why it's never just opinion, right? Exactly because science is a field. We have a lot of, we have a lot of instruments, right? We have a lot of methods. We have kind of a lot of ways in which we deal with these controversies, right? And we also close them. So I wonder, you know, how much you actually consider not just science that's good for citizens, but science in which citizens are part of. But I'm also thinking, you know, given my own work, science in which non-citizens maybe are part of, right? Particularly if we think of the EU, right? And also kind of the global science. How do we think then globally about these methods, right? So I think that, yeah, there are two ways in which we can produce this. At least this is kind of how I try to think about, you know, controversies and being open about them. Because I think just putting data out there, right, the idea that, you know, it's open access, we run into the problem, who's going to understand that? And there's, again, a particular assumption about the citizen. What is the citizen going to do with all those complicated algorithms that maybe not even engineers or computer scientists understand, right? So it's that process and kind of change in methods and discussion.
Coming back to the question of relevance versus independence, of course we should realize that in the case of the scientific advice mechanism, it is science for policy, it's not policy for science. The role of SAPEA is basically to produce evidence review reports, to basically summarize where we stand with the facts, with the evidence, and topics like food from the oceans, like towards an EU sustainable food system, are all very concrete topics. And again, there we need the best available scientific evidence by the best people. And we have them. Also because of course, the existence of the European Research Council and its funding scheme. What is important, of course, also to realize that in some of these topics, there is abundant evidence. In another topic, let's say that we dealt with microplastics, the working group discovered that the scientific evidence base is rather thin. So basically showed the need for more research. So that can also happen, but it is an independent evidence review. There are, after the review is there, meetings with stakeholders, basically to have feedback from NGOs, from industry, etc., etc. But this should not be mixed up with the work of the working group itself. And of course, the topic making sense of science is in that sense a little bit different. That's basically at the core of our discussion. And I think it was, again, the vision of the Commission basically to confront us with this point and say, well, is there an academy that likes to be the lead academy on this topic? Of course, an invitation that Academia Europea could not escape from.
Thank you for all your questions. And I want to say a few things before I forget everything you just brought up. On the question of general trust, which is usually taken to mean a measure of interpersonal trust, how much you trust strangers in your life, I'd say we currently have the data to look at the relationship, but we haven't finished the analysis. So I would think of them as different dimensions, but there may be some touch points, and we are in the middle of, actually, myself and my colleagues have been doing a number of studies about trust across domains, and so we're looking at that now. Want to just bring up the point about a couple of points about the role of evidence in policymaking and kind of what is useful when people talk about policymakers is they often talk about the fact that they have information coming at them from all different sides. And so what a group like SAPEA is doing, if I understand it, is trying to bring the evidence where policymakers are driving what they want to know. There's a parallel thing that we could do with the public.
which is the public has different questions in their lives where they need certain kinds of information. And so there can be venues where you're bringing the scientific evidence to them in areas they care about. And I think that's super smart. And then I take your point that there's a difference between this idea of how much evidence is influencing decisions, either in policy or in people's lives, and the idea of how much do people know about science, the scientific method, or the scientific outcomes principles. And I think often we do blend them, and so we kind of merge them right here, but I take your point that they're separable. And what often happens in terms of when people think about the public is, especially if you're a scientist, you think, why can't the public understand that vaccines are important for public health? Why don't they just see that the risks are so small relative to the benefits? And so they think that they could educate people out of that. But unfortunately, what happens again and again is that doesn't work. It's not enough, perhaps because of processes like motivated reasoning, perhaps for other reasons. It doesn't actually move opinion. And so that's where so many people coming at this from the perspective of public communication about science are saying that that's just the wrong path to go, and we need to be thinking about how people's opinions are formed and moved, which tend to be much more value and emotion based, not so much information driven per se.
Yeah, quickly, please, because I want to take just maybe one more question and then we can wrap up.
Wow, are we really that far? I tend to have last words here for some reason. In terms of knowledge deficit, I think that was your question, yeah? And I mean, I would never dare to say there's anything wrong with putting the information out. This is the science advice mechanism and the academies, that's what you do, obviously. But the best available evidence from a scientific point of view is not more nor less than an empirical approximation to, let's say, reality, which is not the same as truth. Truth would mean that we presume to have a monopoly for truth, and we don't. That means doing that is perfectly fine, but it's insufficient. It's not enough. We need, I think, to do mainly two things. The one is to diversify the perspectives. There are more diverse perspectives out there of disenfranchised audiences, different age groups, different genders, you name it, yeah. Then to engage the stakeholders, as you already said in your remark afterwards, so I think kind of you answered your own question to some extent. So the deliberation and the participation expertise that we nowadays have of how to facilitate a societal discourse on that is the answer, I think, to your question. And the second point would be that I think the governance issues when it comes to regulating new technologies and the foresight mechanisms, I think that governance isn't anticipatory enough, that it needs to be more upstream. We need to anticipate the needs, the expectations, the challenges, the implications much further and much earlier than we do that at the moment. So we talk about reflexivity in the scientific community, which is something that is different from, again, truths and evidence and so on. So if the acceptability of facts is so much larger, where you say, yeah, like, I get it, then the acceptability of the adaptation and mitigation policies that come with it. Hence, you're not supposed to drive that diesel car anymore in the future. You're not supposed to drink water from plastic bottles anymore. If you can't afford a car, if you enjoy certain behaviors in life, if you don't want to change your lifestyle, then this is where we end up with resistances, and that is cultural. It's normative. It's value loaded. Yeah? It has very little to do with people neglecting the fact that herd immunity is a thing. Right. So there are all kinds of factors that come in, and that's why this is super complex. Science is providing evidence and best available evidence and answer, and that's great. But it is not enough. We have to go much further than that. And maybe one last comment, because the question came from Budapest, from Hungary, because it's being said that this is just science for policy and it's not policy for science, or it's not politicization of science, if I may dare to say that. I think, I hope I'm allowed to say that without being impolite to our hosts, but we are in a country where a certain politicization of agenda setting in science is an issue, and where the country or certain parts of the government have decided that gender research is actually not a thing. So it is also a much more complex interface when it comes to advice in one direction and influence in the other. I hope I phrased that politically enough correctly to be safe.
Yeah, and Jason, did you want to make a quick comment? We're actually at time, so if you could be brief.
I'll just make one general comment, which I think responds to several of the questions, which is, I think inherent in good science is good faith skepticism. And one of the things that undermines the effectiveness of science communication or the ability of science to translate into policy is that good faith skepticism can easily be co-opted into bad faith skepticism in terms of distrusting the people behind research or distrusting the motives. So when it comes to trying to equip the public with critical thinking skills necessary to engage in healthy good faith skepticism, it's very difficult to do it in such a way that doesn't also enable bad faith skepticism.
Final words, final thought. And then maybe the final question thought? You can just ask directly. I don't want to hold, yes.
Yeah. just to be completely transparent, in this scientific advice mechanism set up by the Commission, it is the group of chief scientific advisors which is basing their report on the evidence review report by the academies that provides the Commission with options. It is the political process to follow them up or not. It's up to the European Parliament and the Commission. So again, one should clearly define the roles and also not mix them up. Again, of course, the public acceptance is extremely important. And of course, in that context, we have this outreach events. But the public acceptance of legislation by the Commission is, of course, very much also a responsibility of the Commission itself.
I just want to say one more thing, that we haven't had time to talk about how many differences there are among individuals in the public. Jason left us with a cliffhanger that how people interpret misinformation depends on who you are and characteristics about you. And of course, there are many, many differences among the public. And so one of the things we're all looking at is where those fault lines are and how people respond to science information differently. So that's something to keep in mind as we move forward.
Thank you. I think we'll have to stop there. I think that's a good place to stop. But let's thank our panelists so much.